Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, good morning, and welcome to second part of our show as we're live here this morning on January 20th, 2020 on OneRadioNetwork.com. We're streaming live on YouTube and Facebook and on our website. And we have a YouTube channel now with all of the interviews that we're doing, so you can go there, Patrick Timpone. The link is top right of our website. And you can subscribe and like that and like things on Facebook, and that'll help to spread the word on what we're doing here. We're kind of moving things around with our new schedule, so Dr. Pete now is going to be on the third Monday of the month, which is right now at 10:30 Central Time, which is 8:30 on the far west coast, where Dr. Pete is up in the Northwest. He's very popular around the world and around here. He has his PhD, University of Oregon. He specialized in physiology, started his work on hormones in 1968, and wrote his dissertation, in which he outlined his ideas on progesterone and hormones closely related and to it. His main thesis is that energy and structure are independent at every level. We should ask him about that right now. Dr. Pete is on the phone, and he's a Luddite, somewhat like we are, and doesn't do the whole camera thing and all that, and so we just have his picture up there, but that's fine too. Just being able to talk to him is worth it. Dr. Ray Pete, good morning.
Good morning.
How's your life, sir?
Oh, very interesting.
Really?
I had an interview yesterday about philosophy. Interesting change of subject, but basically everything interrelates, so it keeps things interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit, on the idea that your thesis that energy and structure are interdependent. It's almost a spiritual idea that spirit or chi or whatever creates all this is one, kind of?
It's going on all through the universe. The same things that generate energy and order in planets and galaxies and so on, exactly the same thing is happening in our bodies. Energy flows and creates order.
So as we allow the energy to flow more and more, we have more order in our life, in our body, in our health?
Yep. Oxygen is receiving electrons. Sunlight puts electrons into the form of sugar, that's the source of all our energy is energized electrons from the sun in sugar. And when we consume it, if we're really healthy, it goes all the way down to oxygen, forming water. And so the cycle is complete. But if we aren't healthy, then the sugar electron energy stops very, very near where it started and comes out as lactic acid. It's only half broken down, but it becomes toxic rather than constructive. When we burn the electrons all the way down to oxygen, a byproduct of the sugar is carbon dioxide. And the carbon dioxide is what keeps our structure finely tuned and adjusted, favoring that complete use of energy.
Wow, that's just so cool. So the lactic acid and the incomplete use of this sugar could be one of the reasons why sugar is blamed for cancer cells?
Exactly. And for when Warburg discovered that cancer produces a huge amount of lactic acid, even when it has oxygen and should be able to oxidize it all the way to carbon dioxide, people for 100 years now have been inattentive to what that means. There are still exercise physiologists and such who are claiming that lactic acid is a wonderful source of energy and such. But what Warburg started discovering was that it isn't just cancer producing lactic acid, but lactic acid itself produces cancer, keeps it going. It creates the energy block in other cells. So when the cancer cells make turn glucose into lactic acid, the lactic acid circulating in the neighboring cells disturbs their energy, interferes, displaces the carbon dioxide and its metabolism. And so the cancer spreads just by lactic acid to a great extent. And then it becomes systemic that the circulating lactic acid, it can be a test for cancer and general health if they just look at the amount of lactic acid in your blood, because when it's circulating, it's putting all of your body under stress, shifting the electronic balance away from full oxidation, displacing carbon dioxide.
And so we have sunlight, which works with it, the body, and or the energy, which turns into kind of sugar, and somewhere along the line...
We finish turning it into carbon dioxide.
That's in the perfect model. We turn it into carbon dioxide, right? And then what prohibits it from doing that and turns it into lactic acid is what how we create disease by all the different ways we create it?
Exactly, yeah. Just about anything that interferes. The idea of stress is extremely general. It can be too much activity or too little activity. If you're put in a cage so you can't move, the same physiology happens as if you were forced to run on a treadmill.
Same thing, too much or too little.
Yeah. when you're strapped down, for example, your serotonin increases, and the serotonin turns on that cancer metabolism or the stress metabolism. And if you're forced to run constantly, for example, circulating lactic acid suppresses the active thyroid hormone and interferes with your ability to finish the oxidation to carbon dioxide. And so it leaves you in a stress condition.
So the natural progression is to turn this sugar into carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
And then why does the body like to have this carbon dioxide?
People have looked at all kinds of organisms, single-cell organisms of various types, and there are a lot of simple organisms that don't need oxygen. They just need some form of energy. But it turns out that all of the simple organisms that have been tested, even though they might not need oxygen, they still need carbon dioxide. So it's really in the whole picture of life, it's even more essential than oxygen, but most organisms have the oxygen and produce their own carbon dioxide.
And so when we exercise, is there a way to retain more carbon dioxide?
Yeah, just the right amount of exercise. You don't want to overtrain. That's where the lactic acid starts melting you down, increasing cortisol and such, and lowering the constructive progesterone, DHEA, and testosterone. the right amount of exercise increases those constructive steroid hormones and produces more carbon dioxide than at rest. So you're raising your body temperature by the right amount of exercise, and that increases the carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide is binding to all of the cellular proteins and changing, it even changes the way the hormones interact on the cell proteins. Many years ago, in explaining breathing, respiratory physiology, they always mentioned that a major way to transport carbon dioxide on the red blood cells is in the form of carbamino compounds, where the carbon dioxide sticks to an amino group on the hemoglobin molecule. It forms a compound. The acid and the base stick together instantly, and then reaching the lungs where there's more oxygen, that compound decomposes. But strangely, only two or three people that I found over the last 50 or 60 years have been interested in that interesting carbamino reaction. It happens not only in the red blood cells, but everywhere there's a protein with an exposed amino group. And that means the so-called hormone receptors are influenced, modified by the presence of carbon dioxide. So every place there's a protein, basically, the carbon dioxide is going to adjust the sensitivity to things such as hormones. And these groups happen to be where oxidative damage happens. You've seen the so-called diabetic way of diagnosing red blood cells when they're getting glycated. Glycation happens in the brain in Alzheimer's disease, in the blood vessels, in aging in general. And these so-called glycation compounds are sticking the same place the carbon dioxide should be. So if you have high carbon dioxide, any glycating compounds, like breaking down sugar or unsaturated fats, these broken down oxidative particles just don't stick because the site is protected by carbon dioxide binding to it.
Just don't stick. So how, if you're just joining us, Dr. Ray Peet, and if you'd like to be on the show, you can email Patrick at oneradionetwork.com or 888-663-6386, January 20, 2020. You can put a question or a comment on Facebook or YouTube. So knowing what you know about this, and very fascinating, I don't know if all of us were able to follow all of that, but I think we got an interesting concept about the lactic acid and the carbon dioxide. How do you, for example, utilize this information? And you're what, Dr. Peet, you're 83? How do you work with that to help you stay healthy and stick around for a while? How does this information impact the way you live your life?
Oh, I make sure that I take some thyroid to keep my body temperature up and my heart rate up. And every couple of years, I check my oxygen saturation. And if I'm at a high altitude, it's easier to get my oxygen saturation down to the level that is the safest. But just waking up in the morning, when I'm feeling best, my oxygen saturation will go down to 90 or 89 maybe. And if I'm under stress, my finger gadget that measures the oxygen hemoglobin saturation might go up to 98 or 99%. It isn't good to have your tissue saturated with oxygen, because that's competing against the carbon dioxide. You should keep your oxygen and carbon dioxide in a good balance.
So are you speaking of just this little finger thing you can get and put on, and you look at the saturation of oxygen? Now, that's just, of course, opposite of what we're told. The higher number is the better.
But these finger gadgets really aren't the person who invented the saturation instrument had a more complex way of doing it. And these things on your finger, if you put your finger in warm water, you'll tend to have a lower saturation. I've experimented putting my fingers in cold water, and it goes right up to 100% saturation. So it's, if you're not using the oxygen, it'll simply show a high saturation in your extremities. You want to be using the oxygen and making carbon dioxide. So I think the average person ought to be around 93 to 95% saturation in general.
With one of the little finger jobs, finger.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Is that what you use to test?
Mm-hmm.
Really? So, wow. So again, when we're 98 or 99, it's telling us that we need to do what to get that down to 90. What would we do to move that down?
I would sometimes just relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
And paying attention to how your body feels. And if you're just having a thought of things you have to do, that can tend to make you hyperventilate. And just by being anxious and hyperventilating, you breathe so fast, you're blowing out too much carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
And all by itself, that will raise your lactic acid, because carbon dioxide suppresses that wasteful use of sugar and protein.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to hyperventilate. And taking thyroid makes you breathe harder, but it's doing it by producing more carbon dioxide, stimulating breathing. So the amount of oxygen you're moving isn't the question. It's how you're using that oxygen. And if you're using it efficiently, generally, you'll be in the middle 90s, middle to low 90s.
Middle to low 90. So if we are relaxing and learning how to breathe and taking 3, 4, 5 breaths a minute rather than 15 or...
If your thyroid is active, you might be doing fine on 25 breaths a minute.
Really?
It's all a matter of your metabolic rate. A low thyroid person breathing just a few times per minute can still be hyperventilating, because they don't need the oxygen if they're very hypothyroid. And so breathing a normal amount will still be hyperventilating chemically for them.
Hmm. And your body temperature is still one of your main ways, Dr. Ray Pete, that you kind of look at the thyroid.
Yeah. Uh-huh. The temperature, just getting in a warm bath can solve a lot of things. If you're sure you're keeping the energy up, having some orange juice or milk and sugar or something to make sure you don't get low blood sugar. Warming your body either by muscle activity or just by sitting in a warm bathtub will improve your metabolism, lower inflammation by getting the carbon dioxide produced.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Dr. Ray Pete is with us. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. So the body temperature and the TSH and the other metrics we can get with a blood test, do they do they normally correlate together?
Very often, the TSH, if it doesn't easily increase your thyroid secretion, the TSH keeps rising, and when it acts on other cells, the first thing it does is to excite the thyroid gland, and that should produce T4 and T3, which keep the TSH down at a moderate level. But if the gland isn't responding with enough thyroid hormone production, then the TSH keeps rising, and the TSH has an irritating, stimulating action on other cells, such as your blood vessels and bone marrow cells, and it will create a generalized inflammation so that hypertension, a lot of the circulatory problems are caused directly by too much TSH rather than by too little thyroid hormone. So they go together, low thyroid hormone, high TSH, both of them contribute to the problem.
Dr. P, people listening around the world, and if they're working with a doc and doing the natural thyroid, working with the TSH number, are they on pretty solid ground there, do you think?
No, I keep seeing people being diagnosed exclusively on the basis of their TSH. You have to look at the whole metabolism, how many calories they're eating. You can't be hyperthyroid and maintain your body weight on 1,800 calories a day. I keep seeing that diagnosis and people treated for years with a thyroid suppressive drug when their metabolic rate is already too slow. Stress hormones will lower the TSH, so it looks like you're hypothyroid, but you're really just under stress. Looking at large populations and their natural level of thyroid-stimulating hormone, one study found that people with 0.4 below the so-called normal range, from 0.01 up to 0.4, these people were free of thyroid cancer. But as their TSH on average went up, so did the incidence of thyroid cancer. It's the same way that the gonadotropins, FSH, for example, tend to drive ovarian cancer. If you remove an animal's one ovary, the FSH in the pituitary increases and overstimulates the remaining ovary, so that one is more likely to develop cancer. Same with a testicle or an adrenal gland. If you remove one adrenal, the other one overworks and gets too much of the pituitary stimulating hormone and tends to develop a tumor.
So can you here kind of map out for our listeners what you would list as, you know, the bullet points so they can maybe have an idea and take some notes and listen to this and see how they can help to balance this thyroid without going down some black holes? Do you have some bullet points you can put up there of things they should look at and change?
I've seen a few people over the years who were on a raw vegetable diet, for example, eating lots of undercooked or raw broccoli, cauliflower and cabbage and soybeans, and they were developing multiple endocrine problems. Mm-hmm. And just by adding some eggs and milk to their diet, people who were told that their thyroid, or that their pituitary gland was hopelessly defective, just by adding eggs and milk and orange juice, their pituitary function came back to normal. And besides those raw vegetables, probably the two most important things for damaging thyroid function are a protein deficiency. People sometimes get along for years eating only 20 or 25 grams of protein a day, but that just isn't enough to keep your energy running at the proper high rate. And the other thing is the polyunsaturated fats, which even on the ideal diet, they will still tend to accumulate in the body over the years. But if you're eating lots of vegetables and nuts, seeds are generally rich in polyunsaturated fats, and fatty fish and poultry and pork, because of what those animals are generally fed, the polyunsaturated fats are efficient for making the animals gain weight because their thyroid is suppressed, so that they retain more of the food they eat as fat. And so if you eat fatty fish, poultry, pork, and the vegetables that are high in those polyunsaturated fats, you retain progressively. They inhibit the secretion of the thyroid hormone from the gland by blocking enzymes, and they interfere with the transport from the gland to your tissues, and then in the tissues they block the actions of the thyroid hormone. And at the same time, these polyunsaturated fats are intensifying the actions of estrogen and actually stimulating the formation of estrogen. And the estrogen is a major inhibitor of the secretion of the thyroid hormone. So the polyunsaturated fats work complexly on your whole metabolic system. Ultimately, they tend to degrade the mitochondria that produce the carbon dioxide.
Mm, wow. What a trail that you've just, image that you've just painted for us. So what are your favorite proteins if we want to get so many? Do we have a number of so many grams of protein per body weight that is a good starting point?
The National Academy of Science did a study for the Army, and they found that even medium-sized men and women at just desk work, just ordinary 8-hour-a-day activity, nothing very physical, needed at least 100 grams of protein a day to work efficiently. And they didn't specify the upper limit, but the minimum, even for medium-sized women, was about 100 grams per day. And the trouble is that the highest quality proteins are rich in methionine, cysteine, and tryptophan, and all of these happen to be potentially toxic amino acids. Too much of them can cause seizures or inflammation, excitotoxic processes. So ideally, you would get more gelatin-like amino acids. Gelatin happens to be deficient or to lack those toxic or excitatory amino acids, methionine, cysteine, and tryptophan. But fruits have a fair amount of amino acids, typically about 1%, where milk is 3%. So milk happens to have some anti-stress factors, a variety of nutrients and proteins that counter the stress which the excitatory amino acids would promote. And the high calcium content of milk is the most important anti-stress factor.
So gelatin is your favorite. That's the gelatin you can get, Great Lakes gelatin, that gelatin?
Yeah.
It's one of your favorites for protein.
For an old person, that's the best because it doesn't support tumor growth, for example.
Oh, but for younger types, 20, 30, 40?
When you're growing up until 25 or so, mm-hmm. You need the full protein like milk and cheese and eggs.
Mm-hmm. And as the body goes around more revolutions around the sun, it can do well with just the gelatin?
Many years ago, nutritionists noticed that old people sometimes would live on maybe Jell-O and toast or something that seemed completely impossible. But it happens that the gelatin is just about what the old person needs, with just a very small amount of the tryptophan methionine to keep your hair growing and such.
And if one wanted to do animal foods, what, in your opinion, in the literature shows that are some of the most preferable ones to have for protein?
All of the animal foods are very rich in those essential and growth-promoting amino acids. So with age, to be safe from inflammation, you don't want to overdo the growth-promoting, especially if they're associated with polyunsaturated fats.
So then the fatty fish, and you said pork and chicken, poultry, they tend to have more of the PUFAs because of what they're fed?
Soybeans and corn, for example, mm-hmm. Have a very high proportion of unsaturated fats. During the 1940s, it was discovered that those grains produced the best return on investment, a small amount of the fatty grains would produce the best weight production per dollar.
Sure. But even now in the awareness that's out there, Dr. Pete, at farmers markets, you can find eggs from mostly, grass-fed, but then when they do supplement, you can get organic feed with no soy, which sounds pretty good, but even those eggs can have more PUFAs than we want because there's corn in this feed? How can you find eggs that are worth eating?
My friends in Mexico would feed their kitchen scraps to the chickens, and there would be lots of meat scraps lots of tortillas, leftover tortillas, which had the fat removed.
Interesting.
And their eggs were super. The taste is improved as the polyunsaturated fat content goes down. The cholesterol tends to increase, and the taste is better. If you have noticed supermarket eggs, sometimes they will say they're high in N-3,
right.
Omega-3 mm-hmm. fatty acids. I've noticed that those have a very fishy taste. Flax seed has been used as a chicken food supplement for those fatty acids, but I think people notice the fishy taste and tend to stay away from those just after they notice the taste.
So if one were going to have their own chickens and they were going to do supplemental feed, what would be an ideal if they don't have enough grass, like in the winter and such?
Table scraps are very good.
Yeah.
Bread or tortillas or cooked potatoes, all kinds of edible human food is very good for chickens.
Very, very interesting. Dr. Ray Peet is with us. Stay right there, Dr. Peet. We're going to take a quick little break here. And if you have a question, you can join us, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. We appreciate your ongoing support. And basically, if you are new here, what we do at One Radio Network is we're on the air every day. Well, we're on the air now live Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with live streaming. And then we have all kinds of 3,000 hours of audio that you can check out, and then go to our YouTube channel and watch some of the shows and like them. So we have a lot of things here for you on One Radio Network. And the way we support ourselves is, if you look at the right side of our page, some really beautiful, nice little ads and some great products. So if there, you know, if you see something there that kind of tweaks you and makes you look kind of, wow, I want to try some of that. We have some very, very nice people and good people. Ken Rolla, Brandon Amalani, our sulfur. We got some, I think there's some sales on pine pollen going on right now through Tuesday. And you can check this out. Listen. We're talking with health motivator Daniel Vitalis about testosterone and pine pollen. Some of the guys have asked if taking pine pollen would dampen their own testosterone production.
Well, that's something that can happen with the steroidal forms of isolated bioidentical testosterone, and that's one of the issues bodybuilders who are taking steroids often have. What I want to point out about pine pollen is that it's a whole food, and the amount of testosterone that's present is very rarefied. So these aren't really issues that we experience when we take the whole food form of pine pollen or a tincture of pine pollen, but it is an issue if people are taking synthetic testosterone.
Pine pollen. It's a whole food. It's real. And it works for you girls, too. Click and order on any of the Sirthrival links. Exquisitely manufactured. Only from Daniel Vitalis and Sirthrival on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com. And if you look at that page today, Monday, or tomorrow, I believe it's through midnight, you'll see some really nice savings on pine pollen gold, colostrum, 6 ounces, and elk antler velvet gold. You got the prices right there for you. Pretty cool. And Sirthrival always offers free shipping on everything over $200, $100 rather. So that's a cool thing as well. And so this sale, check it out on Sirthrival for the next, 48 hours or so. We're doing some very interesting experimenting. Had a great study that was presented by Dr. Mark Cirkus on hydrogen. And this was a case study that was released about a month ago. And we have that case study on the last show with Dr. Mark Cirkus on the show page, where metastasis in the lungs were completely healed out and cured. I don't like to use the C word because we don't claim that, with hydrogen, breathing hydrogen gas. And you can look at that. I mean, wow, pretty interesting. And here's some information on it, why it might be a good investment for you. Many people have said, and we concur, that the number one investment we should make is in our health. Here's George Wiseman.
Last caller, I'm sorry, I didn't remember his name, said an investment. And this is really the investment kind of thing that you need to do. Not my machine specifically. I think I sell the world's best machine, and I do my best to maintain it and support the customers and everything. But regardless of who you get it from, you really should invest in your health. How are you going to enjoy life if you haven't got health? How are you going to fulfill that bucket list? So number one on the bucket list should be your health, and then you get some extra years. I say this thing not only adds years to your life, because the science is showing a 30 to 50% life extension. So I'm expecting to go to the 120, 150 years old, and I'd help a lot of people between now and then. But it also adds life to your years. There's no sense living in your last decade of life if you're in a hospital bed attached to machines, you know what I mean? Throwing a Frisbee and having fun.
It's so true, isn't it? Boy, if we don't feel good and have the energy to do what we need to do, I mean, what's the point? And here's an investment with a lifetime warranty and also a 1 year, no questions asked, money back guarantee if you don't want it. Check out this AquaCure machine, bubbling hydrogen gas, drinking it, breathing it. This is real cutting edge technology. Check it out in our store. Use promo code ONERADIO for a 10% discount. The AquaCure Browns Gas Machine, OneRadioNetwork.com. And I am not sure exactly how this hydrogen worked on the on this metastasis lung things. I mean, and we've reached out to the people that did this case study on with this one woman and wrote about it. And we're trying to get them on the air, and we'll see if we can get that, make that happen. So stay tuned with that.
We are listener supported, One Radio Network.
With Dr. Ray Pete, and he's going to be here now, and we thank you, Dr. Pete, for taking time out. He's going to be with us once a month on the third Monday of the month at about 10:30 Central Time, and then you can then also check out his website, raypete.com. Sign up for his newsletter, very affordable, and it comes out every couple months. And what do you just write something different every few months about what you're thinking about on your newsletter, Dr. Pete?
Yeah, the current one is on the history and mechanism of vaccination. That relates to many of the things I've been working on, how the immune system works, and what the mechanism of most of the vaccines is creating a local inflammation at the site of injection. They use not only aluminum as an irritant, but many other antigens are in the average vaccine that cause a local inflammation. But that local inflammation leads to a delivery of these same irritants to the brain and the reproductive organs, causing chronic symptoms in a large proportion of the people. It's admitted that 10 to 15% of the people will have maybe a few days of fever from the inflammation, but they're still recommending that pregnant women get two vaccines, both of which contain aluminum. And it's generally recognized that inflammation during pregnancy, no matter what is the cause, inflammation during pregnancy changes the way the fetus's brain is developing.
My goodness.
So the official authorities have acknowledged all of the brain-changing effects of the vaccines, but still they say the vaccines are harmless. You must take them. So this newsletter
is all about that.
It's opening up a lot of themes that I'll be writing about more in the future.
So we've read also and been told by Dr. Cowan that the vaccines, they disrupt this, what he calls the innate immune system, right? The body's immune system?
When I was in graduate school, we had an international immunology conference, and the big shots from all around the world came and did their presentation. And at that time, the innate immune system was considered a primitive thing, irrelevant. These people were talking about the structure and function of the antibodies. That line of thinking was continuous from the time of Paul Ehrlich and his magic bullet. The antibodies were still being thought of as extensions of Paul Ehrlich's magic bullet. But Ehrlich shared the Nobel Prize with Metchnikoff, who was an embryologist who showed the immune function as part of the whole developmental process of the organism, a holistic view. And in the 1960s, this was put aside as a primitive, somewhat irrelevant form of immunity. But now it's coming out that the antibody system is a kind of a desperate last measure of immunity. It's promoted by estrogen and the stress hormones. Meanwhile, the innate immune system actually does learn and is an adaptive immune system, but the antibody people were saying that the antibody system is the adaptive part, and the innate system is merely a primitive forerunner of this fancy system.
So the innate immune system would be a child goes out, or a dog, or whatever, and gets exposed to something, and the body just kind of figures out.
Learns
how to work with it and gets stronger because of it.
And the natural exposure mm-hmm. to irritants and infections is through the skin or the lungs or the digestive system mm-hmm. or even the eye membranes, but definitely not through the muscle where you inject something
the
muscle.
So
it's an absolutely different process.
So the innate immune system, in theory, would then keep getting stronger and more intelligent as more substances
right.
were exposed to the organism, the human, the mammals, the people.
And also in the 1960s, plants were demonstrated to have a learning immune system. The evidence was that the immune system, even in plants, is intelligent and adaptive.
Almost an argument for organic, where the less you mess around with it, if possible, the more it's going to figure out what to do.
There have been studies in several countries. India has done a lot of it, showing that vitamin A can reduce infectious disease on a level comparable to vaccines. And vitamin D is the other essential immune-supporting nutrient. Very few studies have combined vitamin A and D and generally good nutrition. The idea is how to keep infections spreading from poor countries. And vitamin A doesn't cost very much, so they reduce the focus of infection by giving people partial nutrition. But if you simply gave everyone good nutrition, you wouldn't have epidemics.
We kind of understand the innate immune system. So when you give a vaccine with the adjuvants like aluminum and such, talk us through how this antibody theory is supposed to work.
It's a very complicated course. From you have cells that catch the antigen and process it and communicate it to the cells, which supposedly it's a cell that has already mutated to be able to match that antigen, and then that one cell multiplies as a clone, called the clonal selection theory, and that one antibody's descendants produces a flood of these specific antibodies that then persist in the body sometimes for the whole lifetime.
And that's supposed to be a process, the promoters of vaccines, to make the body immune from whatever, measles, mumps, and stuff.
And I got interested in the fact that estrogen promotes the B cells, which produce the antibodies, where progesterone supports the thymus gland and the T cells, which have the intelligent adaptability and multiple levels of interacting with bad factors. And it happens that estrogen promotes autoimmunity. Women have 5 or 10 times the incidence of autoimmune diseases as men because of this influence of estrogen. And the fact that the vaccines are working exclusively on that system, it shouldn't be surprising that autoimmune diseases are the fastest growing in the population. I think it's not only the estrogenic substances, but the vaccines, which work in exactly the same way that estrogen stress does.
Dr. Ray Peters with us January 20th. Dr. Peters, you probably know there's more and more talk about adults being forced, if you will, to perhaps get some vaccines moving forward with all these. I just saw two where they're actually checking people coming now in from China at Los Angeles, San Francisco, Houston, and New York. I mean, you can see the kind of paradigm being built to do, you know, wanting to protect us from all these outside sources, right? I wonder if a 40 or 50 year old would take some vaccines because many people conjecture that you won't be able to fly unless you're up on your vaccines, and we think that's possibly coming. How it affects an adult, a 50 year old, as compared to a 6 year old?
That should have been studied in aging animals. If you look at the actual investigations of how vaccines work and how they work on different individuals, females versus males, old versus young, those studies just haven't been done. They don't care. In 1986, the government passed a law saying that the drug companies would have no liability at all for any harm done by the vaccines.
Right.
And the Department of Health Human Services pledged at the time that they would check and work with the drug companies to improve the safety of the vaccines and would report every 2 years. But 30 years later, a lawsuit, when Freedom of Information didn't get the information, they sued them. And finally, the Secretary of HHS admitted that they had done absolutely nothing over those 30 years.
Nothing.
And when you look at these studies, the pressure is put on the journals so that critical articles have been retracted and denounced as fraudulent just because they were criticizing the dangers of the vaccines. But many of the studies supposedly testing the safety of the vaccines used as a control the whole vaccine minus one antigen. The control contained the most toxic understood part of the vaccine, the adjuvants. So they were comparing a known toxin against the vaccine and saying the vaccine wasn't much more toxic than the toxic components of it. A completely crazy, crooked way to do science. But those articles, no one has pressured them to be withdrawn, even though they're essentially fraudulent.
My goodness. So your latest newsletter is all about this on raypete.com, right? DrPete.com. Wow, fascinating. Here's an email for you. Hello to both of you, or you're just great. Thank you. Two questions. Are thyroid nodules reversible? And do you know a good source for desiccated thyroid?
No, I've looked into many over the years. When the Armour product was sold to a different company, the recipe was changed, and completely different things are put into it now. And for at least the first 20 or 30 years, they were removing the thyroid calcitonin hormone and selling it separately. So I stopped using the glandular. I happen to have some of the powdered pure gland from a chemical company that I trust, but I don't know of any well-defined, reliable glandular product now. So
today you cannot recommend one reliable glandular product out there in the market. I mean, if you had to choose one, which one would you go with for our listeners if they don't have a choice?
I've heard the fewest bad things about WP and Natrethroid.
WP, is that a brand?
Yeah.
And Natrethroid. You've heard the fewest issues about it.
Yeah. But I haven't used them personally, so I'm not sure. I use a synthetic that was designed to be exactly equivalent to the old Armour thyroid product 40 years ago. It's called Sino Plus. It's a mixture of T4 and T3 in the same ratio that the old Armour had.
Oh, Sino Plus. And is that available in the United States? I know you gave us a source in Mexico where you can get that.
That's the only place I know of.
Yeah. Yeah. Do we know that website? I used to have that. People are going to ask, I know.
FarmaciaDelNino.mx.
Oh, yeah, Farmacia. Yeah, we'll put that on there. So it's Sino Plus, S-C-N-O-P-L-U-S?
C-Y-N-O, like Sino Plus.
Sino Plus. And that's got T3 and T4. That's one of the cleanest forms, or it's a synthetic?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the tablets are equivalent to more than 2 grains of the old Armour, so you want to start with about an eighth of a tablet or a fourth of a tablet.
Didn't they come in a powder, too, if I recall? No? Yeah, so you'd have to be careful about your dosage on that one because it's pretty big, right? 120, right?
It's equivalent to, I think, about 130 or 40 milligrams of Armour.
Yeah, Sino Plus. And this lady wanted to know about a thyroid nodules reversible.
I've known basically everyone who supplements the right thyroid. One person was supplementing only T4, which is a very conventional thing to do because it doesn't give you the metabolic effect of the T3, but it does have a full thyroid suppressive effect. But person who wasn't having the nodules shrink after 3 months of a full supplement of T4 added T3, and within just, I think it was about 3 weeks, the nodules had shrunk.
Ah, excellent. Sana writes in, Dr. Pete's current opinion on melatonin, please.
I've been following the research for many years, and one of the problems is that the body produces a fraction of a milligram, and so even a 1 milligram dose, which people use for improving their sleep, that's already unphysiological. But if someone takes 5 or 10 milligrams, then that's really getting risky, I think. There have been studies, for example, most animals, both in the lab and in the wild, their gonads regress during the winter. They don't want to reproduce in the winter. And why that is that melatonin rises in proportion to darkness. The days are short in the winter, and so melatonin rises to a higher level, and it causes regression of the gonads and also of the thymus.
So if one's going to mess with melatonin supplementally, you're talking about really very, very small doses.
Fraction. A tenth to a fourth of a milligram.
A tenth to a fourth of a milligram. Wow. Any specific advice on constant stomach noises? Tummy's making noises.
Oh, I think that's good.
Yeah. It seems like it, doesn't it? Yes.
A person sometimes using a stethoscope so they can hear what their intestine is doing can improve. It's a way of meditating to improve relaxation, because if you're anxious, things go quiet, and as soon as you relax and are having fun, your intestine gets lively.
Yes, yeah. I've experimented with that when I was going through this heartburn thing late at night and relaxing, not breathing hardly, you know, just retaining carbon dioxide. And the more and more I did it and really got really chilled out, if you will, I could just hear the stomach, you know, doing its thing and taking care of any pressure or any burning kind of thing. That's the way it works, isn't it? The more we relax. And so the tummy wants to make those kind of noises. That's what it's doing. It's doing its job.
Yeah. If you have gas, naturally, it'll resonate more.
Yeah. Anna writes in, I've got a terrible sinus issue that makes me extremely tired. It's triggered by cold, usually cold wind, ice cream. I take progesterone, B3, and thyroid and antibiotics, but none of them help. I follow Dr. Pete's diet recommendation. My pulse and temperature seem fine. Is there anything else that I could do? Am I missing something here?
Sometimes it's the lack of a carrot salad. Carrots are antiseptic and anti-inflammatory and stimulate the intestine while binding the toxins such as estrogen secreted in the bile, preventing reabsorption. So it can just having a good-sized carrot salad every day can shift your hormones significantly, reducing such things as sinus inflammation, but also infertile women have become fertile by shifting the balance away from estrogen and the stress hormones and increasing progesterone.
Now, that's one of the few kind of raw vegetables you really like often, right, carrots?
Yeah, because it's almost completely indigestible, and even bacteria are suppressed by it. It doesn't support bacterial or fungal growth in the intestine. So it's like an antibiotic broom that sweeps you clean.
Mark writes in, I have a half of a thyroid gland left after they took the left side. I am currently on Synthroid, and I'm wondering if the other side of the thyroid is sufficient enough to make enough of the other hormones. Could Dr. Pete give me some ideas on this?
It generally regrows and is adequate, but the T4 will tend to keep it suppressed, and that's okay if your liver is able to turn the T4 to T3. The reason the glandular or the balanced thyroid supplement is better is that so many people have poor liver efficiency, and you have to have your blood sugar steady convert thyroxine T4 into the active T3 hormone. If you do everything right, the right amount of activity and balanced nutrients, then your liver will be able to turn T4 to T3. Women are many times more likely than men to have a problem with just T4.
Just T4. Cody writes, in considering that one, we're following Dr. Pete's information and living a long and healthy life as possible, how long does he think one can be expected to live following these ideas?
I think the most important thing is the accumulation of the polyunsaturated fats, which block your ability to respond to thyroid hormone. And so if there's some way to minimize the intake and activate the process of elimination, I think it should be able to go on indefinitely. That's the basic motor of aging, I think.
Our PUFAs, polyunsaturated fatty acids.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, PUFAs they're in nuts, too?
Yeah, except macadamia. I think even Brazil nuts have a fair amount of PUFA. Macadamia nuts are pretty low.
Are they the lowest that you know, macadamia?
The lowest I know of.
Mm-hmm. So, in your opinion, then, is if you go with the PUFA concept, nuts are not a good idea.
That's why I've emphasized sugar and other carbohydrates to reduce the fat intake, even though butter and coconut oil are mostly safe, they still have 2-3% of the toxic fats. And so you can minimize your intake of those if you increase starch and sugar.
Starch and sugar, and how would they be increased? What kind of foods?
Orange juice, tropical fruits in general, the sweet ones rather than the starchy, and all of the nixtamalized grains, such as tortillas, tamales, and so on. Ancient cultures in Asia, as well as the Americas, discovered the technique of cooking grains in lye or lime ashes limestone. Cal is what they call it in Spanish.
And so that's why you could recommend corn, you know, in the tortillas and the tamales.
But because of
the process. But we don't really have access to that unless we go through that ourselves, do we?
It's easy to make if you get organic corn and boil it with the alkali. It swells up, makes hominy. The hominy, you throw away the water because the alkali has turned the fat into soap, and you throw the soapy water away. And then the corn has been partly digested by the alkali so that the protein changes composition, produces some niacin, increasing the nutritional quality of the protein, and partly digesting the carbohydrate, so it's less likely to form gas and feed bacteria.
Do you have specific directions on your website of how to do that?
No, but you can find it anywhere on the internet. Just nixtamalized corn.
Yeah, what's the name of it? Yeah, nixtamalized?
Nixtamalize.
So you probably watch a YouTube video. They probably show you how to do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you for having Dr. Pete on regularly on One Radio Network. He's greatly helped me with my family. I'd appreciate you if you would ask him a couple of questions. One is, would like to know if Dr. Pete ever eats bread.
About 45 years ago, 50 years ago, I made bread regularly, soaking the flour for about 12 hours until the gluten was essentially gone. And so it wouldn't leaven normally. And so I would make up a batter, basically, with powdered milk. And the gluten and starch were turned to sugar. It didn't have any of the rubbery quality of gluten that makes bread rise. So I would make a wet batter and then bake it at a high temperature so it would boil and leaven itself by the steam. And it made a very delicious, non-toxic bread because the long soaking, 12 hours, would convert the harmful proteins to valuable, nutritious proteins, and the gluten was essentially zero.
So you would actually soak the wheat berries?
And then grind them up? I would grind it first and then soak it.
And soak that, wow. But you don't eat it now, Brett?
Not for 40 years.
Not for 40 years. Has Dr. Pete ever married or had any children? And if so, do they follow his work?
No.
No. No above, huh? If getting cold does negative things, how does cryotherapy work differently? If getting cold can do negative things to the body, you've heard of this cryotherapy. People are, you know, doing this very super cold. They jump in these tubes.
It can increase your metabolic rate if your thyroid responds properly.
I was interested in the link that Dr. Pete made between hypoglycemia and lactic acid. I've had some issues with hypoglycemia that I believe with diet changes, but now I've been diagnosed with HCM and AFib that are exacerbated by lactic acid buildup. Is there a link between hypoglycemia and cardiovascular disease?
Oh yeah, your adrenaline and histamine and serotonin, everything, the emergency signals rise. Hypoglycemia and oxygen deficiency are almost identical in the harm they do, and they bring up inflammatory stress hormones and cause things such as nerve muscle malfunctions, heart rhythm problems, inflammation in the heart, kidneys, everywhere. So keeping your the basic reason for hypoglycemia is that it isn't being oxidized fully, and instead it's turning to lactic acid. The lactic acid shifts the electron balance, leads to inflammation and fibrosis, and the rhythm problems are indicating that inflammation and fibrosis are going to develop. So it's very important to get your sugar stable so that the energy is supplied regularly without inflammation. And thyroid is the basic thing to make the sugar oxidized to the stabilizing carbon dioxide without lactic acid. Just breathing carbon dioxide in an emergency, like breathing in a bag, you've probably heard of that. You rebreathe for a couple of minutes, and the carbon dioxide accumulates in the bag and is rebreathed. As the oxygen goes down, the CO2 rises, and that will lower the stress, anxiety, arrhythmia signals, tending to suppress the lactic acid. I've known people who were having high blood pressure who in one day brought their blood pressure down to normal by many
breathing
episodes of rebreathing in a paper bag. Did I mention previously a book from about, I think it was 1905, 1908, somewhere in there, called The Medical Uses of carbonic acid?
Yes, yeah. That's, we should mention that, the medical uses of carbonic acid.
I don't remember the author's name, but yeah. You can find it. It has a good section on treatments starting from, I think, 1790 through the 19th century, treating cancer with putting pure carbon dioxide gas in contact with a tumor.
Wow. And in general, as we relax more and don't breathe as much, we retain more carbon dioxide, right?
Unless things are fairly bad, it really helps to have a thyroid, a T3 supplement, and something like orange juice and milk to support the system with an ideal chemical environment to help you relax and get your own CO2 and T3 production going.
And milk and orange juice does that, two of the things.
A milkshake or ice cream or marshmallows, anything in an emergency can help you break a cycle. When you've been under stress for a while, your glycogen stores in the body are depleted, and we store almost the typical person about half a pound of sugar is stored in our muscles and brain and other tissues. Hmm. And once those are depleted, if you only eat, say, half a pound of sugar or carbohydrate in a day, you're going to be using most of that and might not be storing enough. So the amount of sugar or other carbohydrate that you need to replenish those stores, it's kind of amazing how much it takes if you make sure that your thyroid is okay, then eating ice cream and marshmallows and so on, you can see the change in your blood pressure. I've experienced stress that depleted my glycogen so that I had maybe a 160 blood pressure over 90, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And by eating as much sugar as I could get in along with other foods, I could bring those numbers together to a 40-point spread instead of a 70 or 80-point spread.
And that's preferable.
Your blood is circulating efficiently when the spread is reduced.
With sugar?
Or starch to get your carbohydrate more than you're burning, then you can store it as glycogen.
Mm-hmm. Like a potato.
Take pounds and pounds of potatoes to replace once you get depleted. But if you're aware of, if you're checking your blood pressure frequently, you can see the pulse pressure, the difference between top and bottom. You can see it decreasing as you make headway of getting your glycogen stores back up so that your T3 is working.
Dr. Ray Pete is with us, January 20th, Patrick Timpone. Kate writes in, I've read where people that consume just a little bit of alcohol per day actually are longer lived lives than people who don't consume any. What does Dr. Pete think about just a little bit of wine?
In some physics labs, they've found that ethanol at a very small amount is a very powerful antioxidant. And some biological experiments, they found that age pigment was regressed from brain cells with vitamin E, and in their control, they found that the vitamin E was contained ethanol, and as a control, they did just ethanol and found that it regressed the age pigment. But the amount it takes to do that is on the order of maybe a teaspoonful of alcohol per day, from 1 to 5 cc's of alcohol is enough for that antioxidant action.
So maybe a tablespoon of whatever, agave tequila or something, could be beneficial.
I think so.
Loretta writes in. She's on Facebook. Hi, Loretta. What does Dr. P think about protein shakes for meal replacements?
If they're made with a powdered protein, the process of powdering it exposes the particles to oxygen, unless it's ground under nitrogen gas and so on. So you just can't get a powdered protein that is, well, gelatin contains none of the oxidizable or easily oxidizable amino acids. So powdered gelatin is okay for a supplement in a drink.
Mm-hmm. Loretta, what Dr. Pete is talking about, you can look up Great Lakes gelatin, and it's grass-fed, I think moo cows, and you like that as one of your best sources of some kind of protein, right? Better than whey or whatever.
Yeah, because when you concentrate and dehydrate, the proteins containing cysteine and tryptophan, they are very susceptible to being oxidized into toxins.
Here's one for you. This is kind of interesting. Lorenzo wants to know, well, what's the difference between cow milk and goat milk? I seem to do better on goat milk. Is that giving me all the goodness that you talk about with drinking milk?
It's got all of the nutrients. It's richer in some nutrients, and the cream particles are different, so that for a lot of people it's easier to digest because of the just the consistency of the cream particles.
Mm-hmm.
But it does tend to have a little more of the minerals. But partly it depends on what the cows are fed. If the cows have a good grass diet, mostly their milk is very digestible and safe.
Mm-hmm. Goats eat a lot of stuff, don't they? They eat a lot of, they eat everything, don't they, goats?
Yeah, you have to make sure they don't eat junk.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email for you. How toxic is fluoride, and what instrument or instruments? Wants to know. Okay. How toxic is fluoride, is first question.
It's very toxic, and it tends to accumulate in your bones and teeth, and when it's bound in a crystal, it isn't actively toxic. But in the process of getting there, there were studies, Yamayanis and Dean Burke, did a study showing a correlation between fluoridated water and cancer, and that has been intentionally denied by the fluoridation authorities. But animal experiments show that it has toxins, including carcinogenesis.
So just a little bit, you just don't want to put it in your body, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you play any instruments? Writes somebody.
Cello is my favorite.
Cello.
I bought a very nice one for $300 Paracho's is the town in Mexico that makes them.
Do you know about CRISPR gene editing? CRISPR gene editing.
The whole idea of working on people's genes, gene engineer is going to be as competent at engineering the genes as our cells are. A bacterium is constantly editing and revising its genes according to situations, and if bacteria can do it, we can do it. But when you try to do it in a test tube, it's always lacking information that the whole body has. The whole body evaluates the situation of our chromosomes and can modify them accordingly with the various epigenetic mechanisms. But the genetic engineers are missing almost all of the actual mechanism that produces appropriate changes.
I think it's becoming more and more interesting to think about the possibility that we are manipulating and changing all of this with our state of consciousness about what we think and believe.
We're continuously interacting with the environment. Mm-hmm. When we talk, we're modifying each other's brains. The whole organism changes in the process of talking and listening and understanding. Those changes, ordinarily, it doesn't cause drastic changes, but in bad situations, it can be the decisive factor.
Wow. So it's not a stretch to think about the idea that if people would sit, watch TV, the news, that that energy, these words or whatever is involved in it, is going into the body.
When I had TV 20 years ago, I was watching some Supreme Court judges talking, and I took my blood pressure, and it had gone up to 168 over 110. I could tell that their thoughts were harming me.
Yeah, wow. Here's an email or a question on YouTube, watching on YouTube, from Splizzy. What does Dr. Pete think about molecular hydrogen and its research so far? Seems to fall under Pete's paradigm of regenerative versus degenerative metabolism, favoring the regenerative side of things.
We have enzymes called dehydrogenases, which can, in principle, use hydrogen instead of glucose or other molecules. The NADH molecule that transmits energy from glucose or protein to be producing energy. I think hydrogen molecule can be handled by the enzymes that handle NADH and transmit hydrogen electronic energy into the electron transport chain to produce carbon dioxide or produce water, and you wouldn't be getting your carbon dioxide if you relied too much on hydrogen, but producing energy, I think it can be constructive.
Yeah. Did you hear that case study we talked about with the metastasis and using molecular hydrogen? It was fascinating. Wow. Can you understand how that could possibly work?
By reducing inflammation, I think, mm-hmm. is
yeah.
the inflammation is an imbalance of electrons, and sometimes just not having enough energy is a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you cut off your oxygen or glucose supply, you go into that stressed condition that produces dangerous electrons, and glucose or hydrogen, I think, can often solve the problem.
Interesting. What does Dr. Pete think of taking cold showers? Also, I tend to have cold hands in the morning, but they warm up towards the evening. What could this be related to, or does it say anything about my body? Cold showers in general, do you think the body likes to get cold and get stronger that way, this whole cold idea?
If your thyroid function is low, you should check your waking temperature and pulse rate, as well as your midday temperature and pulse rate. If your metabolic energy is low, getting cold can slow things down even more. and put you over into the inflammatory state. When your feet, for example, are around 90 degrees Fahrenheit, they start producing inflammatory signals that affect the rest of your body. So your hands and feet are the quickest to get cold when your metabolic energy is low. And a cold bath in that situation just can make things worse.
So the body temperature and the pulse rate, what would be a sign then of, in general, of a balanced metabolism going on in the morning?
Waking up with, a 98 degree temperature and 70 beats per minute.
Yeah, around. So that 98 to 98.6, you're not too picky about getting all the way to 0.6?
By about 11 in the morning, it should rise about half a degree from the waking temperature.
Mm-hmm. And if it would not, if it would stay the same, say 98 throughout the day, you would want to maybe look at maybe a little thyroid?
Check the situation changes. If your night is very stressful, some people will wake up with a 98.6 temperature and a 75 beats per minute heart rate. And then after they start having orange juice and milk and sunlight, their temperature will go down to maybe 97 and a 60 beat per minute, because the nighttime stress can give you artificially increased metabolism at waking. So it's important to look at the change. It should rise. Your metabolic rate should rise after breakfast and stay there till sunset.
Mm-hmm. What does Dr. Pete think about this fad or fashion that's being talked about, intermittent fasting, where people just eat 4 hours in the afternoon, say from noon until 4 p.m., and they don't eat again until noon the next day? Could this possibly be beneficial for the body?
No, I don't think it...
No, you don't see much?
The studies on mice, I don't think are applicable. It's important to look at the right species and the right combination of foods and the timing. It depends on the age and so on. If you don't have a very high metabolic rate, one meal a day might be okay, but with a very high metabolic rate, going 20 hours without food can bring on stress.
Mm-hmm. Here's one for you. If you put boiling water in powdered gelatin, does that damage the proteins in any way?
No, they're very stable.
Really? Well, so you could actually put this Great Lakes gelatin in a hot drink if you would, or put it something like that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Can Dr. Pete share some specific remedies that people can use to break out of chronic inflammatory patterns, such as stress-induced aerobic glycosis?
Thyroid and orange juice and milk are the quickest ways.
Orange juice, milk, what was that one?
Thyroid.
Thyroid.
A thyroid T3 supplement in particular.
I think I misunderstood when I asked you about if you're on a desert island, of where you would, what you would take with you. Would you say again what you would take with you if you only could do a few foods? I'm going to make sure I got it right.
I don't remember.
You don't remember what you said. I think it was orange juice and tortillas and...
Cheese, maybe,
yeah. You think there's a big difference between organic raw cheese and just cheese?
They're now manufacturing cheese with engineered microbes and things that you just don't want to expose yourself to.
Yeah, yeah. Raw cheese, you think, easier to digest than the pasteurized?
Pasteurization doesn't necessarily heard it, but it's the additives that I think should be avoided.
Yeah. Final question for you, then we'll let you go back to work. This is a very profound question. What does Dr. Ray Pete think about eating peanut butter?
I years ago, they were finding that I think it was about 30% of the peanut butter samples they tested contained a very toxic fungal metabolite. And just that risk, I think, is enough reason to avoid it.
That could be why so many people are allergic to peanuts, I guess. What is anaflaxin? Why? There was something, whatever it is.
I think aflatoxin.
Yeah. And I guess there's no reason to believe that an organic peanut is really organic these days with drift, and we just don't know, do we?
Even organic things can have fungus growing on them.
Oh, it's the fungus in the peanut. Yeah. Cool. Well, Dr. Pete, again, thank you for being here. We had a good time. Again, tell folks your latest newsletter that they can get at drpete.com is all about vaccines. History of vaccinations. All right, sir. It's an honor to talk to you. You're doing good. Thanks for taking care of us and taking care of yourself. We'll see you next month, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir. Bye.
Bye.
Dr. Ray Pete, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. Well, it's kind of cool listening to a fellow that's been around 83 revolutions around the sun and still has this mental capacity going on and doing all this research and writing. He's got something going on. All right, kids. We're going to have a little special show for you tomorrow with Andrew Goss. It'll be the one-year anniversary of his translating, leaving his body. The last show we did with Andrew Goss on One Radio Network. I still miss Andrew a lot. I'll start crying if I talk about it. I won't talk about it too much. But so we'll do that tomorrow. And then I think we'll run the David Wolf one on Thursday. It's a great show that we had trouble with my internet. So we'll run that on Thursday. But then we're doing live shows, and we're going to actually start doing more and more live things on Monday and Wednesday. So check out our website, OneRadioNetwork.com. All the shows are being posted in audio. If you just, download those and listen while you're exercising and walking and such. And remember Adam Bergstrom? He's going to be back more than once a month. We're going to work some things out with Adam, who we love. He has a blog on, Adam's blog, every 2-3 days. Great stuff. Very original material. You're not going to find anywhere else with Adam's blog. And Dr. Jennifer Daniels is going to be here, I guess, next week. And Ken Roll will be back. We're going to talk about castor oil next week. So we got a lot of good things. Let us know people that you'd like to hear about. And we appreciate your ongoing support. And that's how we do the financial thing at One Radio Network, is by you purchasing some of the products. Now, if you don't need anything, don't buy any stuff. We're fine. We do good. But if you need something and you want to look around on our website, in our store, and on our website, I think you'll find some very nice products. Sir Thrival, Shen Blossom, the Aloe, the Blue Shield is a great thing for protecting you from EMFs. Check that one out. Ken Rolla and his Golden Pyramid, nice thing to put in your room, where you sleep. The sauna, amazing. I use it every day. Not that that matters, but it's really something to check out. The Living Streams probiotics are great. Sulfur, people love it. They just keep ordering for years and years. So there's something going on with our sulfur. So a few of the things that we work with. Dr. Cowan's powders, don't forget those babies. Some amazing vegetables. There's no way you're gonna eat burdock or all these other different powders. He has some great turmeric and sea vegetables. So we have some cool stuff. So I love you all very much. I thank you for your ongoing support. Thanks to Sharon for holding this whole thing up, because I'm, you know, out to lunch most times. And let me know if we can help with anything. Just email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. So I love you all. Thank you, and may the blessings be.
Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.